HD Smartcast. You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to A View from the Stands, a podcast series in which we discuss the new normal in the world of sports. I'm Aditya Iyer, and with me is the national sports editor of HD, Rudraneel Sengupta.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A View from the Stands. And on today's show, what else but the great Novak Djokovic and his historic win at the French Open? Well, and this obviously starts the entire debate again, the greatest of all time. 34-year-old Djokovic, the youngest of the three big tennis stars right now, Nadal is 35, Federer is 39. Becomes the first player in the Open era to own all four Grand Slam titles at least twice. And he's on track for a slam sweep this year as well. He won the Australian Open and he's the defending champion at Wimbledon. And of course, the US Open is a favorite court of his. And it would also give him 21 majors and take him beyond Federer and Nadal. But frankly, I'm a little bored of this debate over who's the greatest of all time, because for me it sometimes just takes away from the fact that we are so privileged to watch some unbelievable tennis being played by these three men. But before we get there, let me introduce our two guests on this show today, Aditya and Rutvik, both tennis nuts, much more so than me, watches tennis all the time, knows everything about it. And so welcome Rutvik, welcome Aditya. And I'll start with a question for you, Rudvik. You know, I spoke on and on about Djokovic, but there was also Barbara Krejcikova, if I'm getting the pronunciation right, winning both the singles and the doubles at the French Open, a first since Mary Pierce in 2000. You tracked her matches quite closely. What were they like?
Right. So for me, the biggest thing about her story was just her persistence and the fact that she kept going at it, because she is predominantly a doubles player, and she kind of thought of almost quitting singles last year, and she came back saying, okay, let me just try it and have some fun with it. And she surely did have some fun with it, and she upset a lot of people. She upset Sofia Kenin, then she upset Coco Gauff, who was playing so well. So I think hers is just the tale of, you know, just coming back to doing what she loved, not worrying about anything else, and reaping the rewards after all those years of, you know, not having anything to show in singles, despite being such a great doubles champion herself. And to win both is just the icing on the cake, I suppose, for her. She has now reached the world number one in doubles, and she's also got her highest rankings in singles. So, I mean, as incredible as the French Open was for Djokovic, I think it was equally incredible for this Czech.
But does this win for Krejcikova, does that open up, does that mean that we have another strong contender in the women's singles game right now? Or do you think that this is going to be a more of a one-off thing for her?
Well, I think it would be a one-off because, you know, she hasn't even played the main draws of Wimbledon and US Open before, which should tell you that she might not be much of a contender, at least in Wimbledon and the US Open. Clearly, clay is where she feels more at home. And certainly in singles, especially this French Open was so wild in terms of the women's seeds just, you know, tumbling off one after another. Osaka quitting, Halep not being there. So I genuinely think, like we've seen with a lot of French Open champions before, like Ostapenko and women like that, that it might be on off.
Right. Aditya, I come to you with something that, of course, we spoke about a lot on the day that it happened. And you cried, and you were in mourning, and you didn't eat lunch or dinner, and so much happened there. And I had to console you. Of course, I'm talking about Nadal and only his third loss at Roland Garros. And it came at the hands of Djokovic, of course. Just tell me a little bit about how that was for you.
Yeah. So, firstly, you know, despite all the consoling, you still made me write an article that day. So, yeah, thanks for that. But you know, absolutely ridiculous, because as we know, Nadal had lost just twice at the French Open before this, one of them to Djokovic. But, you know, as I've said over and over again, even in the articles, you know, the first loss in 2009 was to Robin Soderling, but he was also really suffering from foot blisters, right? It just wasn't boding well with him. And in 2015, he was completely out of form. Like, just to put that in perspective, in the clay swing leading up to the French that year in 2015, when he lost to Djokovic in the quarters, he had lost to Djokovic in Monte Carlo. He had lost to Fabio Fognini in Barcelona. He had lost to Andy Murray in Madrid. And he had lost to Stan Wawrinka in Rome, right? So, like, yeah. No one really expected him to do much because it was the first time he really went into the French without winning any clay titles, right? Mm-hmm. And in the fourth, he ended up dropping a set to Jack Sock. So, you know, if an American is taking sets off Nadal at the French, you know there's trouble. It was pretty ominous, right? But this time, there was none of that. He was on a, four French Open titles streak, 30-plus unbeaten games, 30-plus matches in Paris without dropping a set. He dropped one set to Diego Schwartzman in the quarters and all hell broke loose. Like, you know, we were, people like Ruthwick and I were basically texting each other back and forth, wondering if he's going to lose. And like, he promptly whipped Diego Schwartzman 6-love in the next set, in the fourth set. So, you know, coming into that Djokovic match, he basically had like the craziest form, and Rafa in that form never loses. And then he goes 5-love up in the semi-final against Djokovic, right, in the first set, which was so similar to the final last year where Djokovic was bageled in the first set, and you know what set off possibly his most one-sided loss in a Grand Slam final. For Djokovic to fight back from there, including, you know, as again, you know, that set that we've all spoken about so much now, that absolutely mesmeric third set. Yeah, incredible. But also, as you began, personally, really, really difficult to watch, man.
And while you were mourning all of that, Ruthwick was celebrating something else, which is the rise of young Italian men's tennis. we had a few very, very good performances here. Lorenzo Musetti, Matteo Berrettini, Yannick Sinner. What's happening there, Ruthwick?
Yeah, I think this has been on the cusp for a while now. Italians, these two teens who are there are making waves, and more so Sinner because he's already reached 1,000 final. And he was actually the only one who kind of troubled Rafael Nadal in the previous French Open. It's very similar to the Djokovic match where it kind of went into the night and Nadal was kind of struggling for his rhythm. Sinner had set point in the first set and then kind of, you know, drifted away, much like Musetti did against Djokovic here. Clearly, they have some work to do, but as their games have shown that they are ones with, you know, great promise. And Berrettini has obviously risen quite, exponentially. Even his match against Djokovic, I don't know if you guys saw it. It was late at night and Djokovic had this loud scream right at the end of it. You know, it was probably a more emotional celebration than any of his victories at French Open. And he later said that it was a very intense match and he felt like he had to kind of wriggle his way out of it. So the Italians have left quite a mark in Paris, and I guess they're here to stay for a while.
Right, and of course this French Open, there's so much to talk about because we also saw Roger Federer's return after a very, very long gap, after rehabilitation from injuries. Then he eventually pulled out. But while he was there, Aditya, what was he looking like? His clay is not his big, clay is not his surface. He's only won the French Open once. But was it great to see him back on the court, just to see Roger Federer hitting a tennis ball again?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, I think you kind of nailed it there, right? It was just, that was the main thing that people took away from his return over here. But the old man can still dance, man. Like, you know, It's just such great news to watch him, go into the tiny little grass swing that there is now in an ATP calendar the fact that, like, he didn't really lose a match over here. He pulled out after his win against Koepfer at night. Just, there wasn't much news leading up to this French Open, at least good news when it came to Federer, because, you know, he had last played at the Aussie Open in 2020. he was already looking old then. Like, he struggled to kind of, like, you know, put Tennis Sandgren away to make it to the semifinal where he was duly beaten by Djokovic. This year, he had lost to Nicolas Basilashvili and Pablo Andujar coming into the French. His only ever win in this year out of the three matches was against Dan Evans. So no one really expected much. But again, I go back to a Ritwik article where he said that the main thing is basically Federer coming into the French and playing on clay because, like, it's just invaluable court time, right? Like, and he got just that. Yeah. And, you know, in a year that he's turning 40, a year he's coming back from two knee surgeries to put away Denis Istomin the way he did in the first round. And then that fabulous game against Marin Cilic, followed by the Kopfer win, the one that he did win. Yeah, just great, you know, to see him go into Wimbledon now, a place where he lost that heartbreaking match against Djokovic in 2019. That was the last Wimbledon played, and that was the last match played in Wimbledon, actually. He's already playing in Halle. I mean, if that makes you happy. He plays Felix Auger-Aliassime today. So, yeah, he's truly set up going into what is his favorite part of the calendar year.
Oh, it makes me very, very happy. Like I said in the opening, I'm not a big fan of this whole greatest of all time discussion or even the term greatest of all time. I mean, really, sports is an emotional thing. It's an emotional connect. You can tell me, okay, that Pelé is the greatest footballer of all time, but for me, it'll still be Maradona. Right? You can tell me that Ronaldo scores more goals than anybody else, but I'll still think Messi is my favorite. So it's a technicality in some ways, and clearly it looks to me like that Djokovic is going to overtake both Federer and Nadal just because age is on his side, just because he's such an all-court player as well. Okay, of course, yes, he is, and he's going to overtake them and all of that. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to stop. Saying that Nadal is the greatest of all time for me. You know, so what I'm trying to say is it's very personal.
Yeah, I think you're kind of speaking for a lot of Roger and Rafa fans over there, right? Because I don't think in the end it's going to be numbers that stays with them, because this man from Serbia is pretty much going to destroy all of that on the way.
Right.
But that emotional connect, that love, like, it can never go. It can absolutely never go.
Yeah, like Goran Ivanisevic was the greatest of no time ever. But you remember him winning Wimbledon? We all do. Yeah. Right? I mean, what could have been better than that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes the numbers just take emotions away from it. But I'm digressing. Let's talk about another new thing that happened at the French Open, which is the night sessions in Paris. Was that a nice idea? Was it something you guys liked? Watching tennis at the French Open at night?
I think it is a nice idea, but it probably could have been next year, because clearly no fans at night makes it, you know, it kind of defeated the whole purpose of having night sessions, which was to create an atmosphere.
Let me just say something as somebody who loves Paris, is that even if people are allowed in for night sessions, I find it very hard to believe that Parisians will actually go to watch a match instead of going to a restaurant to eat dinner over 3 hours with wine.
That is a good point. That is a good point, though. That's a good point. But just the fact that, you know, people were not allowed, and in the Djokovic-Berrettini match, actually, you know, it had to be stopped, and then, you know, the entire court had to be vacated, much like what we saw in the Australian Open. So, and people were, that Tsitsipas-Medvedev match was slotted for the night when everyone was like, you know, it should have been during the day with fans on court. It kind of robbed the sheen away from that match as well. So it is a nice idea. It's obviously they are trying to, you know, break away from the tradition and everything like that. And they want to obviously cater to new audiences. But probably in these pandemic times, with all the curfews and everything that they had, it might have been a good idea to push it by a year, but they had announced it last year itself, so it might have not been possible. Luckily, they allowed Djokovic and Nadal, that match at least, to be carried on with fans, because if that would have been emptied, and it would have been just a massive, massive anticlimax.
Yeah, but of course, that defeats the purpose of the protocols in place, right? So it was a bit of an odd decision to take. If you are going to allow people in because of how cool the match is going to be,
that's true.
That can't really be the reason. But yeah, so, you know, Djokovic, Nadal, that incredible semi-final. But leading up to the semi-final, Aditya, did Djokovic look like he was going to be able to beat Nadal?
Leading up to the semi-final, Rudra, Djokovic looked like he looks like in every single Grand Slam, which is, you know, he's giving a lot of these lower-ranked guys hope by giving them a set or two over here or there. I mean, there's a real honest feeling amongst Rafa and Roger fans that Djokovic might kind of be doing this on purpose to test himself before he plays some of the big guys. And there's enough data to back it. Because, you know, there's no one really making Djokovic feel like he's warming up properly for the second week of a slam, apart from the guys at the very top, right? And he meets none of them in the first week. In fact, the 2015 US Open, I asked him something very similar after he allowed, and I would really say allowed, Roberto Bautista Agut to stretch him to, I think it was a crazy four-setter. And I asked him if it's better, to kind of get these matches out of the way at this point rather than the following Sunday. And he was like, you know, who wants to get over it? Because these are the same matches that you're playing later in the week as well, right? Like, so it's just lovely if the test begins early. And I think that's pretty much what he's doing, right? Like, he took a Grand Slam debutant in Lorenzo Musetti, went down two sets to love, changed his clothes and then whipped him. Whipped him, I mean, as in like really whipped him, right? Like, I think Musetti won one game in the next three and pulled out halfway through the fifth because like there was just absolutely no point playing. And as Ritwik just brought the quarterfinal game up, like that was also just like, you know, such a great talking point when it comes to Djokovic and trying to pump himself up for the big moments. Had the first two sets, like completely lost momentum in the third. And again, I'm putting lost momentum in quotes. And in the fourth, when Berrettini looked like he was going to push it into a fifth, it was all but done. You know, there's something about him, man, like the beast in him that kind of needs those points, like those clutch points where he plays some of his toughest tennis before going and playing someone like Nadal in the semifinal, where he knows that he's ready. Like, and yeah, of course, as Ritwik said, you know, that like he looked like he was going to like fling his racket at a box where his wife was seated. And like in a completely empty stadium, he started like pounding his chest and started screaming Serbija. It was all a bit, like bordering on lunacy. But yeah, that's Djokovic. So yeah, it was just absolutely typical, if you ask me, leading up to that Nadal match. Nothing typical from there on.
Right, but I mean, this could be a strategy. Why not? Because if you are ice cold mentally, and if you have a lot of belief in yourself, you could allow yourself. I mean, just to maybe even just to give yourself a break, you might want to lose a few games here and there, because you know that you're going to pick it up, or you could lure your opponent into believing something and then completely shatter that belief, like Muhammad Ali did with Ropa Dope, right?
Both, the Ropa Dope, So. In the final against Tsitsipas, the moment he went two sets down, there's a friend of mine who sent me just those three words, rope a dope, and exact. And I was like, man, anyway, yeah.
So should we just ignore that semifinal loss right now and not talk about it, just so that we don't feel all collectively really sad about what happened, and you know, and just go on to the final and talk about that? What do you think?
I think that's a good idea.
That's a very good idea. Wholeheartedly support that.
So yeah, we all watched the final. What was it? What was for you, Aditya? What was the big thing in the final? And I love Tsitsipas, by the way. I think he's fantastic, and he's going to really be, and he already is, and is just going to grow stronger and stronger with each slam. He's going to be the big contender along with Djokovic.
Yeah, agree. I mean, you know what? Let me just focus on Tsitsipas here, because you brought him up. I just have a feeling that, you know, this particular generation, 25 and below, right? Let's not count Dominic Thiem as being a part of this generation. He's properly in between the two. He's been around for a long time now, and he's pulled off a slam in the US Open. And he also pulled off a slam, very importantly, against a guy from this very generation in Zverev, right? Zverev was two sets up, just like Tsitsipas was in this match. But Zverev was also a breakup in the third, if I'm not mistaken. And Thiem turned it around from there. So this generation, you know, these two matches, the Zverev game and the Tsitsipas game, are quite emblematic of the problems faced by these kids, right? Like, they're making all the right moves. They're making slam finals. They're all winning London Masters, now the Turin Masters, basically the year ending, the year ender. They've all won them. Medvedev has won it. Zverev has won it. Tsitsipas has won it. And they're making all the right moves in the slams too, in the Masters too. But it's just that, you know, when it comes to closing the deal, they're not able to do it because, and I'm sure we'll come to this by the end of our podcast, is really because these three maniacs are still around, right? In Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer, and they're just refusing to give up. I promise you, if it was 40-year-old Roger Federer in the final of a slam that he's known not to like too much against Tsitsipas, and if he was two sets down, I would still back him to do the rope-a-dope.
How hard is it to close the deal against somebody like Djokovic? I mean, just talk about the final. And
talking about the final, you know, and very interesting what Aditya said before about Djokovic and his love for testing himself. Interestingly, after Musetti, he said, you know, I like playing five setters against these young guys. And he very specifically said against these young guys. Even in the final, you saw his body language. There were no panic buttons, nothing. He just went off the court, came back, recharged, and let's do Djokovic things again. So, I mean, he kind of gave indications about it after the Musetti game that five setters I love because these young guys are still not quite there yet. And he was confident about it because he knows what it takes to beat them across five sets. So, which is why there was no indication or no body language or nothing about his game that said, oh, I might lose this. Nothing at all.
Perfectly summed up. Right. Perfectly.
And Aditya, does this mean this calendar year, all the slams are his? And maybe even the Olympic gold?
Sheesh, great and scary things, exactly like the things that you just mentioned, right? Like, you know what? Just like, let's go back about 15 years, right? For him to start winning slams in an era where Nadal and Federer didn't really leave much for others to win is quite incredible by itself, right? But now, just like fast forward those 15 years, come to today, for him to win and be on 19 Grand Slams and put himself within one of those other two, I mean, like, you know, it just kind of tells you why this is the greatest era in any sport, like in absolutely any sport, not just tennis, right? According to me, at least. Mm-hmm. And what's really scary is, like, you know, he had already mastered beating Federer on grass. He's beaten him in three Wimbledon finals. But now he knows how to beat an informed Nadal on clay. Right?
Yeah.
There is no limit after something like that, man. I mean, like, forget just winning all four slams this year. It also happens to be a Golden Slam year. You know, if he does it, then he'll be doing what Graf did in 1988 in the year of the Seoul Olympics. But I think, like, way more than that, like, I think what really scares tennis fans like all of us is, I don't know, just how far he's going to push that all-time record, right? Like, he's got 19. Yeah. These two guys are 20. He's 6 years younger than Roger. He's a year younger than a very tired Nadal, you know, physically beaten Nadal. I mean, not just because of this year. Nadal, who's been beaten up over many, many years through injury and, like, just how physical his game is, right? I can see Djokovic going on for another 6 years, can't you guys?
Well, I mean, even if he goes at peak performance for the next 3 years, or maybe conservatively, let's say 3 years, right? I mean, that's still going to stretch the record by a mile.
Oh, yeah. great and scary things, like we said, great and scary things.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And if I may add, what sets Djokovic apart for me from these two is that he does not shy away from stating that he wants to go for it. You know, you hear Nadal and Djokovic and Nadal and Federer saying, oh yeah, they are just numbers, 20, 21, whatever, all time great. But Djokovic, like, I want it. I mean, even after the French Open, he said, everything is possible. Golden Slam, why not? Calendar Slam, why not? And he wants that. So he publicly is very clear about what he wants, and that is to break all records.
Yeah. Yeah. This, he's really the Ivan Drago of tennis, man. That's the only way I can sum this up, you know. I mean, perfectly summed up, Hrithik. But I fear him the way I feared Ivan Drago when I first watched what is one of our favorite movies, Rudra. I mean, we've already established this in one of the earlier podcasts, but this for me is he's the very embodiment of the real Ivan Drago.
Right. On that note, breaking all records, the Ivan Drago of tennis. Thank you so much, Rudvik. Thank you, Aditya, for joining me. And thank you, all the listeners. And we'll catch you in the next episode.
Thanks, Rudra. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was an episode of A View from the Stands. Do like and follow us on at HT Smartcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or write to us on podcasts@hindustantimes.com. You can listen to more podcasts by logging on to htsmartcast.com.
This was a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.